Oscar. Oscar's in England, Surrey, to be precise. On his way to the town of Crowsbeak, or Crow's Hat, or whatever it's called. After Morocco, the English landscape still seems absurdly green. The car made him feel uneasy at first, but he rolled down his window and watched the hills outside rising and falling, and it made him feel better. The green looks delicious. He wants to smell the colour of it, stick his head out, open his mouth and taste it, the just-gone frost, the tender blades of grass. "Look, Oscar," the guy at the airport had said. His name was Frobisher. "The problem is that we need to speak to you, but you don't have an email, you won't take calls and you don't answer letters, so we end up having to track you down." He sounded baffled, as if he expected Oscar to explain himself. But Oscar had decided early on that he was going to maintain an unyielding silence. So he did. He folded his arms and tried to look impassive, even though it was probably obvious to both of them that Frobisher had a full house and Oscar had dropped all his cards on the floor. "We don't want to harass you," Frobisher continued. "I mean, I personally have got better things to do than follow you around Marrakesh." He gave a friendly laugh, but Oscar's arm stayed folded. "Do you even know what we're trying to talk to you about?" said Frobisher, and now he sounded almost exasperated. Oscar wasn't falling for that one. He gave Frobisher a long stare. "I don't know if this is a trust issue," Frobisher said, "or you're just angry, or what. That's understandable. What happened should never have happened. Now it can be put right, if you want. You don't want to talk to me, that's fine. All you have to do is listen. My job is to explain the situation. I can do that right now and give you your options. That's it. You can do what you want after that. Is that okay?" "Okay," Oscar said. "Fire away." He regretted the choice of words immediately. "And ultimately, it comes down to this. Nothing." It's not like Oscar believes Frobisher. Frobisher said he came to give Oscar information, but Oscar has no way of knowing if any of it is true. Frobisher said options, but that's essentially bullshit. There's one option, one story, one source of information. Frobisher himself. He laid it all out over the wonky-legged airport table, and Oscar went along with it, because it's Frobisher or nothing, and Oscar has had enough of nothing. It's like that riddle, "What's greater than God, more evil than the devil? The poor have it, the rich want it, and if you eat it, you'll die." Well, Oscar had been living on nothing for a long time, and he knows that if he has to do it any longer, he'll die. Frobisher seemed to understand this. His experienced eye saw that Oscar was a thin fox, ready to drop. He said, "You can change your mind at any time. Just go to the clinic. Talk to them." And Oscar said, "Okay." When they landed at Heathrow, a flight organised and paid for by Frobisher, Frobisher said a driver would be waiting for Oscar in arrivals. "You're not coming with me?" asked Oscar. "No. I'm catching a train and going home. You're going to a place. It's nice. Like a hotel, but with doctors. You'll stay with them for a couple of weeks and get evaluated and interviewed and so on. Everyone's expecting you. You only have to give your name. Have you got everything you need?" He was looking at Oscar's mostly empty backpack. Contents: passport, squashed Moroccan pastry from the airport, credit card, a few dirhams. I have no idea what I need, Oscar said. Maybe some warmer clothes, Frobisher suggested. I know you haven't been back to the UK in a while, but flip-flops in November are a no-no. Is that what month it is? Oscar said. It's hard to keep track. Frobisher seemed now to want to get away. He was looking at Oscar like Oscar was on his doorstep trying to sell him cavity wall insulation. Oscar reassured Frobisher that he did have a credit card and he would clothe himself appropriately. Good, said Frobisher. Then I'll leave you to it. He shook Oscar's hand and wished him all the best. And that was that. Oscar wandered the shops, bought himself some jeans, a coat, and some brown leather shoes. Then he went to Arrivals, and there was his driver, holding a card that said, Oscar Levy, which sent the usual electric shock through Oscar before he remembered that he was meant to be known. That his name, maybe for the first time, was a good thing. It only takes half an hour to get to the clinic. A bit too fast for comfort. Oscar isn't quite ready for it. Not the gates, the tallness of them, or the protesters, the number of them, or the clinic itself, the fact of it, its existence in real life. The car comes to a stop. Is this it? He asks stupidly. Of course this is it. His hands are trembling.
This is it, says the driver.
Oh. Are you sure? Okay. So, I just get out here then, and go inside. I suppose I do. Yep, that's what I do now. Oscar pinches off the shakiness by making fists. Unfortunately, this just has the effect of moving the shakes up his arms and into his chest. Now his heart's going. He gets out reluctantly and walks towards reception. He looks back. The driver is still sitting in the car, watching him. And so Oscar has to pass through the large glass doors into white. Everything is white. In the corner is a receptionist, sitting behind a curved white desk. He walks over to her across the shiny white floor. He notices that when the receptionist greets him, there is something careful about her politeness, as if she's as tense as Oscar. The receptionist asks for his name, nothing more. She asks him to take a seat and wait. Oscar goes over to the other corner of the room and sits down on a white sofa. Nothing here jogs his memory. Maybe that's intentional. That's why the design brief was blank and white. Though in its absolute blankness and whiteness, the place is kind of memorable. It doesn't remind him of the place he remembers, with the chair and the white coat. That was white too, but there was something different about that place. The vibrations of the noises, the density of the atmosphere. He can't explain it. It's just not the same. After about 20 minutes, the receptionist leaves. She says she'll be back in a moment. She definitely looks edgy. He hasn't seen anyone else in all the time he's been here. As if everyone here is so frightened of Oscar that they're hiding in their offices until he's gone. He looks out at the grounds, filled with a sportive light bouncing about on the grass. Beyond the wall of pines is the road out of here. He wonders if anyone's ever escaped over the wall. Maybe he'll be the first. The thought's a half-hearted one. Oscar already knows he's not going anywhere. They all know it. That's how they can leave him here alone. He's not going to run away now. Just because he's got no idea what this procedure will do to him. If it will flip him neatly inside out like a surgical glove, left to right, all his ins now out. Just because he's fucking terrified. The receptionist comes back as Oscar's leg is starting to jitter. Mr. Levy, would you come this way? He follows her ushering arm through a door. It leads to a white corridor. Oscar knows now. At the end of it, there's going to be a room with a reclining chair upholstered in pale grey vinyl, a coat hanging on the door, a lifeless kind of light. So this is it. Well, fuck it. He walks towards the final door with a weird feeling of acceptance. The sweating in his hands has stopped. His fingers hang at his sides. This is how everyone says death is. This volitionless floating towards the end, only minus the sense of euphoria, the singing in the ears, the blinding beauty. Oh, sorry, Mr. Levy, it's this way. What? It's this room. This one here. The woman is holding open a door behind him, the first door they'd come to, off to the right. Oh, says Oscar, walks back to it. Sorry. Inside this room, there's no reclining chair, just a desk, some large plants in pots, four men in suits, and a framed black and white picture of a beach. All the men get to their feet. They smile with varying degrees of sincerity. They take it in turns to shake Oscar's hand and tell him who they are. Man number one says he is Clifford Byrne, director of something and something here at Nepenthe. Man number two says he is Francis Hathaway, a Nepenthe solicitor. Though Oscar is not to worry about this, as Francis Hathaway's presence is really only a formality. Man number three says he is Alex Medvedev, a Nepenthe psychologist. Man number four says he is Michael Goldman. He is the youngest of the four and is apparently Oscar's solicitor. I'm here to represent your interests, he says.
Because I don't know what they are, says Oscar.
Says Michael.
Basically, yes.
Okay, Oscar says.
Have we met before?
Actually, the solicitor who originally represented you retired. The case was passed to me. We haven't met, but I know your family. Your Uncle Simon? Your Aunt Rebecca?
I don't know those people, Oscar says.
Hopefully they'll come back to you, says Michael Goldman. The talking after that takes a while. The men say mostly the same things that Frobisher said, which means either Frobisher was telling the truth or they're all in on the same lie. They tell Oscar about the restorations. Everyone wanting memory refunds. A giant rewind button pressed. People walking backwards to the clinic, coming out as younger versions of themselves. Money flowing out of the clinic's bank accounts, confidentiality agreements unwriting themselves.
I don't get it, says Oscar. If someone spent a load of money to get rid of a memory, why would they want it back?
Most people don't, says Clifford Byrne.
But you're telling me that I do, Oscar says. That this is what's best for me.
We're not making any claims as to your future condition, says Francis Hathaway.
That's reassuring, Oscar says.
It's true that we can't guarantee what the results of this procedure will be,
Dr. Medvedev says.
Your case is very different to that of the average client. It's not a matter of one unwanted memory. It's more complicated than that.
Because you scrambled my brains, says Oscar. Then everyone starts talking at once, at Oscar. They use a lot of words, clinical trials, government approval, rigorous methodology, full and informed consent, settled in court, generous compensation, stacking the words up in front of them, one on top of another, like a wall. Oscar almost feels sorry for them, rushing to protect themselves. From Oscar! It's actually funny. It's okay, he he says to them. You can stop explaining it. At this, the wall is dismantled. The men come out, cautiously, from behind it. They're still talking, but this time they're using lots of words that aren't exactly sorry, but are clearly meant to stand in for it. Regrettable, unfortunate, hindsight, best intentions. Okay, Oscar interrupts. If you're telling me the truth, the gist of all this is you only wipe the short memories, but not the long ones, or the old ones. Wipe isn't exactly the word, and you don't wipe those because it doesn't work. Well, the procedures in themselves were successful, but there were some adverse consequences. And you know about the adverse consequences because you guys were doing dodgy secret research. I have to point out here that there was no illegality about the Rasser clinical trial, and confidentiality was necessary to protect, and these Rasser experiments ended up messing everyone's brains up. That's not the terminology we would use. No, I guess not. I have problems remembering the right terminology, though, which I guess is technically your fault, so maybe you'll let me off? Silence. Oscar, Michael Goldman murmurs, and I apparently volunteered for this when I was 21, though obviously I can't remember it. Michael again. You did volunteer, yes. We have all the documentation you signed, which is available to you. Sure, Oscar says. Look, let's just do this. Hook me up. Unwipe me. Unzap me. Whatever you do. Then we'll see afterwards what happened to me. Or what I did. Then I'll read the paperwork. Side eye to Michael Goldman. That's okay, right? It's your choice, says Michael. My choice, repeats Oscar. He looks at the men, sitting there so gravely. They could be anyone. This place could be anything. He's getting twitchy. His palms have started sweating again. Maybe he is dreaming. He could be in the Riad beside a snoring Jess. He could be a child the age of Atticus, having dreamt his whole life. If it turns out that he's in a coma, like the guy in that film, what's this procedure going to do? Is this his way out? His way of waking up? Let's do it, he says. They go into another room. Just Oscar and Dr. Medvedev this time. In this new room, the light is white, but it's still not the same as the light he remembers. There's a smiling nurse in here, a window onto a room of computers and people who ignore Oscar's arrival, a white-sheeted bed in the corner. Where's the chair? Oscar asks. The reclining chair? I'm sorry. The what? Asks Dr. Medvedev. Never mind. If you lie down here, the nurse says. She's holding a small plastic cup. Where's the laser? Asks Oscar, looking around. No lasers. It's a chemical compound. Once it takes effect, we pass electrical waves gently through. Gently? How do you electrocute me gently? It's a very mild current. It just works to activate areas of the brain. You're waking up my memories. That's a good way of putting it. Well, what do you know? That's the first time someone around here has liked my way of putting things. They are looking at the cup. Oscar raises it to the nurse, Dr. Medvedev, and the people beyond the window. Bottoms up, he says, and drinks. They've turned the lights up to full beam. Faces dissolve in the intensity of it. He wants to tell them, but his throat is too dry. Right, he whispers. A hand is in front of him, holding a plastic cup.
What is it?
Just water. Drink it slowly. And when you're ready, sit up slowly. It's going to take you a while to feel steady, so don't rush.
So, how does this work? Oscar asks.
Just try to think of something you know, something you can remember. You should find it connects to another memory now. Oscar thinks of the white corridor. And he's there. As soon as he thinks it, he's walking along it in a smaller body than the one he has now, his feet tiny in their new fluorescent trainers. The feet hesitate. The flat, artificial light spreads beneath the closed door. He stops, looks at his dad.
It's fine, his dad says.
Appointments are over.
Go on.
His mum looks up when Oscar runs in. She's taking off her white coat, hanging it on a peg behind her. Beside the empty chair are the traces of pink swill in the sink, cold spit and tooth polish grit. Spit and grit, a good rhyme. His mum removes her gloves, holds out her hands.
Aussie man, where's my hug?
He goes and wraps his arms around her. She smells minty.
Home? Says his dad.
Absolutely. You too, Tara.
Tara, the dental nurse, is switching off the light above the reclining chair. She turns on the tap, and the pink of the last patient disappears.
What's up, Oscar? She says.
Tara once gave him a sheet of stickers, each one with a smiling canine on it.
I'm a happy tooth. I get brushed every day.
Oscar has wondered before if there are stickers with crying teeth on them.
I'm a neglected tooth. I'm a rotten tooth that never got brushed. I'm a sad tooth.
Night, guys,
Tara says, leaving. See you tomorrow, Rachel. His mother puts on her coat, a grey moleskin velvet, a nap that would raise up if you rubbed it the wrong way, making a dark streak on the fabric. He brushes it now, the cuff, as he takes her hand. The exact feel of it under his fingers. The necklace, Oscar thinks. And then he's in his garden, the sun coming down in bits and pieces, scissored up by the trees. He's eating strawberries from the large terracotta planter beside him, 3 so far. He'll stop at 5. Which he's calculated is the number he can eat without it being noticed. His mum comes out just as his hand's reaching for number 7. He drops it, acts nonchalant.
Aussie, we need to get some sun cream on you. It's getting hot out here.
Hotter in the kitchen, though. Dad's making a cake. Don't ask me why.
Chocolate cake?
Carob and apple, but just as delicious.
The problem with both parents being dentists is that nobody sneaks him anything when the other one's back is turned. They're both on the same side, the side of good dental health. Oscar has tried to argue that his baby teeth are all going to fall out anyway, and so it only makes sense for him to start eating healthily when the new ones arrive. They ignored that. His mother strokes his hair. As if she hears what he's thinking, she says,
When your milk teeth are all out, I'm going to get them cast in gold and made into a necklace.
Really?
His dad says from the kitchen doorway.
What? Says his mum. It'll be hideous and macabre. Didn't some serial killer do that?
What's a serial killer?
Oscar asks.
Nothing. Your dad is being silly, his mum says.
Listen, Aussie man, my necklace will be beautiful because I think it's beautiful.
Oscar's father laughs, surrenders.
Fine, lovely, whatever you say.
Something else is worrying Oscar.
Aren't you going to give the teeth to the tooth fairy?
He asks.
Ha,
says his father.
Answer that one, Rachel.
Of course I am, his mother says. But we dentists have a special arrangement with tooth fairies. It was a pact made thousands of years ago by the very first dentist and the very first fairy. They met on the moon, on a mountain in the shape of a tooth, and they carved the words of their pact into the side of it, that the tooth fairies still take the teeth and the children still get their money, but later on, if they have some special plan in mind, like my plan, the dentist can send a message to the fairies and ask for the teeth to be returned.
How do you send the message?
His mother doesn't even blink.
Under my pillow, of course, but only on a full moon.
Of course, says his father.
The first thing we learned at dentist school. I don't know how I forgot.
Silly daddy, says his mother, and they laugh. And Oscar joins in, wondering why it's funny. With half his mind on the security of his tooth fairy money, now assured, the other half on the forgotten carob cake still baking, maybe burning. Like the last time his dad got distracted when he was making avocado muffins, and they went and got ice creams instead.
Oscar's eyes swim and well. He needs water, but his throat is too tight to get the request out. He signals instead, gets water in a plastic cup. Tears spurt from his eyes as he drinks, as if the water is cycling up and straight back out. He hands the empty cup back, lies back, closes his eyes. Water, Oscar thinks. Oscar and his parents are on holiday. They'd loaded up the Volvo and off they went, first visiting Uncle Simon and Aunt Rebecca near Latuque, then heading on to a villa near Deauville, owned by his father's friend, which they'd got the use of for a couple of weeks in exchange for some free dentistry. Oscar, squinting in the backseat sun, is relieved that his cousins, Leah and Nat, are getting further and further away every minute. Both of them black-eyed and black-haired, like two apprentice witches. They were bloody annoying. He told them that, then got ticked off for saying bloody, though in the corner of his eye he could see his mother trying not to smile. Maybe because she was the one who'd said it in the first place, and was made to apologize. Then the cousins knew they'd won that one, and Nat said that if Oscar didn't help them with the castle they were making in the rockery, stupid bloody castle, they'd tell their parents he said bloody again and it'd be two against one. So he helped move stones and repile them and got bitten by some weird French ants. Then, on the last day of their stay, when the castle was discovered and Uncle Simon blew his top, the bloody twins claimed it was all Oscar's idea. On the plus side, Uncle Simon and Aunt Rebecca had let him have ice cream at the beach and biscuits out of a green glass jar, and his mum had unexpectedly allowed it, shrugging and saying, "Well, we are on holiday." He wonders how long this permissiveness is going to last. The wondering is slow and enjoyable. A drowsy reel of Soleros, Ferreros, Polos, Rolos. A long, unwinding strawberry string of rhymes. The sun wraps him like a blanket, heavy and familiar. It seems easier to close his eyes than to squint against it. "Look at Ozzy," his mum says now. "He's half asleep. Those girls tired him out."
"No, they didn't,"
Oscar says immediately, eyelids snapping up. He clarifies,
"But I do hate them."
Her eyes float in the rearview mirror. One of them closes, reopens. She's the only one in the family who can wink. But Oscar and his dad can roll their tongues.
"Why, Ozzy, what a thing to say.
two young girls. But she's laughing, and his father says, young in years, but old in wickedness.
Well, it'll just be us at the villa. The four of us, his dad says. Side-eye to Oscar's mum's football-sized, apparently soon to be beach-ball-sized, stomach. Oscar asks,
can we call the baby something that rhymes with Oscar?
What rhymes with Oscar? Nothing rhymes with Oscar, his dad says. That's partly why we called you Oscar. I was Addie at school. Addie the baddie. Addo the saddo, etc. Whereas your mother never got bullied because she was called Rachel. Hang on. I never got bullied because A, I didn't wear glasses, and B, I never told anyone I wanted to be a dentist. Oscar presses on.
It could rhyme with Oz, like Loz.
Or Roz. Actually, Roz is cute. Rosalind. Rosamund.
Look, Oscar. Look at the water.
His mother points. Below the bridge, the wide river is shivering silver. It's like a giant, sparkling piece of silk pegged to the ground, trying to shake itself free.
Or Fozzy, says his dad. Like Fozzy Bear.
Shit!
Oscar looks up. He can't understand what he is seeing. Then he can. It's a truck. All the windscreen is truck. And it's moving too fast to see. And the noise is louder than all of them. He's trying to get to his feet, and they're trying to stop him. Try to stay calm, Mr. Levy. Just breathe. Please sit down. A new cup of water is offered. He reaches for it, misses, knocks it out of the nurse's hand. It hangs for a moment in the air, trembling. Then, as it was always going to, it hits the ground. Later, they say his dad died immediately. Oscar doesn't say anything to that. He could have told them that actually there was a moment after his dad's head was obscured, in a red crackle of surprise, that Oscar heard him speak. But he didn't know what his dad said. The noise was so squashed by whatever had happened to his face, and so there didn't seem any point in explaining it. His mother had spoken. She screamed at first as the car hit the water. But then she stopped abruptly and turned to Oscar in the back. Her eyes were wide and clear and rational. She got this look when she was making a plan. She'd be silent for a moment, the look would appear, and then she'd say something like, "Right, Oscar, we need to get you to the shoe shop before term starts." Or, "I'd better let Tara know about the 9 a.m. cancellation." She looked at him then and said, "Oscar, can you undo your seatbelt?" Oscar was crying and didn't listen. There was too much. The strange side of his dad's head. What he could see of it. The water flooding through the smashed windows. It was foaming pink. It was so loud. The car rocked like he was shaking it, like it was his own voice doing it, drowning them. His mum twisted and pulled her body as much as she could back past the front seat. She couldn't get all of herself through, and Oscar thought it was because of the football-sized stomach, but they explained later that it wasn't that. It was because her legs had been trapped when the lorry crushed the front of the car. She got hold of Oscar's seatbelt and undid it, pulled him between the seats, past his father, out through the empty, jagged hole of the windscreen. Her hair was pressed, wet, against her face. There was no blood on her at all. Eyes wide. Calm. The water came in over them. Then the car was traveling downwards, and Oscar was going up, holding his breath, beating his arms and moving up to the surface where the grey light jittered, because he knew she was coming too. She was right behind him. Oscar felt for a long time after that as if he'd been tricked by someone he couldn't be angry with. They said he couldn't have helped her. Her legs were trapped, they kept telling him.
Nothing could have been any different. It wasn't a sacrifice. It wasn't a matter of her or him that had to die. He doesn't say, but why couldn't it have been both? If she hadn't looked so calm, maybe he'd have understood what was going on, stayed with her, so she wasn't all alone at the bottom of the lake when she died. Instead, he got to the surface and bobbed about, screaming for help, like a bloody idiot. He got pulled out by people he never thanked, because at some point he twigged and started to fight them instead, trying to get back into the water. Someone held him, and he kicked them, to stop them carrying him away, back past the jackknifed lorry with its wheels steaming, the gathered, staring crowds. A woman had her hands pressed against her mouth. Away from the hanging metal of the bridge barrier, the water below. It was calm. The car was gone, and the surface had mended itself quietly back together, rippling gently in the afternoon light, like nothing had happened. They give him her necklace. There's the house in Chippenham too, but Oscar is too small to live in it by himself. Burrowed into his parents' bed, an eternal Sunday morning, waiting for them to wake up. Instead, he and the necklace go to Uncle Saul and Aunt Bee's creaky, high-ceilinged old house in Bristol. After a year or so, Uncle Saul, who is old and ill, and Aunt Bee can't cope with Oscar anymore, so he goes to Uncle Matthew and Aunt Nicky's house in Poole. When, a few years after that, it turns out Uncle Matthew and Aunt Nicky can't cope either, Oscar is sent to live in France for the summer, with Uncle Simon and Aunt Rebecca. Everyone agrees, all the executors and guardians and legal representatives, that it'd be better, more stabilizing, for Oscar to stay in England. But he's run out of uncles and aunts in England, and family abroad is considered better than strangers at home. He doesn't want to go back to Latuke. It wasn't Aunt Rebecca and Uncle Simon's fault, obviously, but the last holiday he'd spent with them didn't turn out all that well. But Uncle Matthew and Aunt Nicky are divorcing, and, according to Nicky, whispering at night, this is in large part Oscar's fault. He'll send you to an early grave. How can you say that? It's just an expression. But anyway, it's true. And anyway, I can't deal with him. I just can't. Everyone thinks Oscar has turned a corner after he gets to Latuke. Healing, they say. What they mean is easier to cope with. Really, it's that the proximity to the crash has knocked the fight out of him. What was he fighting? Everyone. Everything. Not in the obvious kind of way. He never raised his voice or hit anyone. He just ignored people until it drove them mad. He wore them out with knots. Not eating, not talking, not listening. In Latuke, he sits by the old rockery and digs the weeds out, waiting for the weird French ants to come out and bite him, but they don't. Nat and Leah have actually turned out okay. Still black-haired, but not witch-like, not really. Not that it matters. They want to help him and be his family, but Oscar isn't up for more family. Been there, done that. Thank you very much, but no. He isn't able to explain this, so he just avoids them, and in the end they give him a respectful berth, watching him across the space he's created with their sad, dark eyes. After the summer, he says he wants to go back to England, to boarding school, and nobody argues with him. They probably all hope it will help. He's 12 by now, old enough. And it's not like money is an issue. There's the life insurance and a payout from the Haulier Company, none of which Oscar gives a shit about.
As soon as he's escaped Le Touquet, Oscar goes back to not. Not listening in class. Later, not going to school. Not seeing his relatives in the holidays. Not answering their calls. Stealing a gun, not giving it back. Not coming back to his dorm for entire nights, then entire weeks. Not contesting his expulsion. Not stopping drinking. Then, when he got taken to hospital, not telling the nurses his identity. A protracted turning of his back. A long, messy knot. "This isn't the first time you've got into trouble," says Oscar's solicitor. He stares at her and says nothing. "Oscar, we want to help you." Oscar can't see how that's possible. He's finally got beyond help. That was the entire point. He's 18, no longer a minor. He's dropped out of school, and he's into heroin by now, which seemed like the biggest knot anyone had or could ever come up with, and so he took it, gratefully. But heroin wasn't the biggest knot, was it? There was one more. The ultimate and final knot. This knot was contained in a chamber of the cylinder of a gun once found in the possession of a famous musician, then in the house of Lonnie's dad, then under Oscar's bed, now in Oscar's hand, in an empty supermarket, being discussed by a group of junkies and ne'er-do-wells. Things to do with a gun. Because something must be done. Suggestion 1. Stage a heist. Too risky. And also, hassle. Suggestion 2. Find a quiet place and shoot some inanimate objects. Too boring. Suggestion 3. Mug someone. Bad karma. And also, hassle. At this point, it was starting to look like the gun wasn't going to fulfill its destiny after all. Not unless Oscar stepped in with Suggestion 4. Russian roulette. Russian roulette? Ha ha ha. Wait. Man, you're fucking crazy. Are you serious? He's serious. Oscar, don't do it. Oscar, is it loaded? 3 bullets. Aren't you meant to do it with 1? He's going to fucking kill himself. Oscar, stop it. Oscar, this isn't funny. He sees his parents. Water separates them. He'd like to say it was the ripples that obscure his vision, but the truth is he can hardly remember their faces. 1 knot to part the water. Oscar! Oscar, don't! Bang! Nothing. Oscar sits on a wall alone. The sky is black, and the Thames looks like a dirty piece of glass, small lights reflecting off its broken edges. They took the gun away from him, wrestling it off him as he shouted at them. One of the girls said she'd hand it in to the police. "Fuck you," Oscar said to her. Then he said, "Sorry." Then he left. They all stood there behind him, not saying anything. He walked down the empty aisle with its signs hanging overhead. "Cereal," said one. If he'd actually shot himself, they could have called him the serial killer. It would have been his first successful joke. He'd walked the rest of the night and morning, finally ending up here, in the heart of the city. The skyscrapers stare impassively at the sky, like they're averting their gaze from Oscar below. He stares at the water and feels a corresponding, shifting, oily misery flowing through him. The river comes up through him. It reaches his eyes, leaking polluted water. If he opens his mouth, it will pour out and out and never stop. At dawn, he buys a newspaper and sits in a coffee shop without reading it. He has no plan. The day overtakes him. The sun comes up. Then the rain comes. People with suits and umbrellas come in, order coffee to go, then go. At the time, it feels like a sign.
Latte, please. Grande. I hear they're paying a lot for the trials at Nepenthe.
So says a woman in a skirt suit.
It's pronounced Nepenthe, says her colleague.
She has a small, sarky smile.
And they'd need to pay. I mean, who are these people? Hey, let's find out if wiping my memory has catastrophic long-term effects. Jesus. Espresso, please. Double. Thank you.
They both laugh, passing to the end of the counter, beyond Oscar's hearing. And Oscar thinks, what was that, if not a sign? A word from a higher power, or the universe, or his parents even, saying, this is better than killing yourself.
Oscar gets up and leaves the coffee shop, moves with new purpose across the lightening streets, heading for the station.
I'll do anything, he says to Nepenthe.
They say this isn't considered informed consent. First, he has to hear all about the procedure they're testing, wiping the memory of early childhood trauma, how secret the nature of the RASA trial is, top secret, and what could go wrong, a lot. And then he has to sign a large number of forms. Whatever, he says. Just make it go away. He isn't at the actual clinic yet. It's some other office in London. A woman named Dr. Nightingale is there.
Like Florence, he says to her.
Florence Nightingale was a nurse, she says. I'm a doctor.
What does Nepenthe mean?
Oscar asks her. It's an old word, quite obscure, really. It was a forgetfulness potion.
Was that on purpose? Oscar says.
Naming a procedure to make people forget after a word that everyone's forgotten.
Perhaps, Dr. Nightingale says.
She doesn't smile.
Listen, Mr. Levy, I need to make sure you are fully aware of the risks of this kind of experimental procedure. Because the risks are numerous and significant. They could be life-changing. Do you understand this?
I don't like my life, Oscar says.
I don't care how it changes. I don't honestly care if it ends. Anything is better than this.
Dr. Nightingale looks at him. She sighs.
Okay, I'm satisfied with the results of your evaluation. However, please bear in mind this is only the first stage of assessment. I'm going to hand you over now to Dr. Russell, who's running the RASA trial, and his team.
You aren't running it.
No,
absolutely not. I'm just conducting the assessments. You won't see me again.
That's a shame.
On the bright side, maybe Dr. Russell will find my jokes funny, Oscar says.
Probably not, Dr. Nightingale says.
But, on the bright side, you won't remember if he doesn't.
Which is funny, and Oscar laughs.
Bring on the next stage of the trial, he says.
They warn him the necklace will confuse him afterwards, but he says he wants to keep it. They seem confused, and why wouldn't they be? That he can get rid of everything, his parents' house, their things, every memory of them, but not that.
Your choice, they say.
They say that a lot.
We really do think, says Dr. Russell, leaning forward, earnest, that this can give you and other survivors of trauma the best chance of a happy life.
The weird thing was, Oscar felt like he meant it.
Oscar's sitting up.
They've cleared up the water he knocked out of the nurse's hand, and he apologized, and everyone raced to be the first to say that it wasn't a problem, that this was a stressful time, and so on. He's taken back to the first room to rest and await his chat with Dr. Medvedev. He notices a box of tissues within arm's reach on a small table next to the sofa. They're expecting him to do some more crying then. His solicitor, Michael Goldman, must still be around somewhere. He remembers Goldman and Bude now, the firm chosen by his uncles and aunts. Michael Goldman wasn't lying. He is here on Oscar's side. Or as much as any solicitor is ever really on anybody's side. The only time Oscar ever heard his dad swear was when they were buying a new house and he found out about the solicitor's fees. Shifty fuckers. I could do it myself, he said. Not this again, said Oscar's mum. No, you couldn't. Well, no, and that's because they've made it impossible for people like me. We can't even access our own records. It's a conspiracy. It should have been simple, but instead it's a flipping Masonic Illuminati ritual. He turned to Oscar. Listen, Ozzy, if you're paying someone to do something that you don't understand, they're probably screwing you over. Addy, let's not embitter him too early. I'm preparing him for the world, right, Ozzy? Don't forget your father's wisdom. Oscar covers his eyes. He forgot. He pulls tissues out of the box too quickly, tearing them. He's never cried much before, not even after his parents died. Maybe because it's been so long coming, all the things he could have cried over appeared again, in no particular order or weight, like someone's picked up a box and turned it upside down. His dad asleep on the sofa as a film played, because he could never make it through a film without nodding off. Atticus on the flight home, worrying about his brother. His mum singing Madonna, better than Madonna, but being too shy to ever do it in front of people. Just a voice slipping out under the bathroom door. Not saying goodbye to Carolina, to Jess, to anyone. He's out of tissues, but the tears are easing off. The images have slowed to a trickle. Just one last kick from a hurt-looking teacher whose class Oscar disrupted. And that's it. When Dr. Medvedev comes in, Oscar feels like telling him it's too late. How are you, Oscar? Asks Dr. Medvedev. Obviously, there's a lot to take in. A lot is right, says Oscar. You guys took a lot away. You really fucked it up, right? Dr. Medvedev hesitates. One moment, he says, leaving the room. When he comes back, he's accompanied by the solicitors. Do you mind if they sit in? He asks Oscar. Be my guests, Oscar says. So, the results of the first phase of the Rasa trial weren't promising, sadly, says Dr. Medvedev. He speaks carefully. We decided to end the program. What this meant for you and the other subjects is that the memory of the early childhood trauma was successfully removed, but it turned out that too many secondary memories were connected to that primary memory. We're still not sure exactly how it works at a neurological level, but the theory is that you'd probably spent a lot of time thinking about your parents, and this content was entangled somehow with other moments in your life. As a result, a lot of your other memories would have seemed dissociated, patchy, or disrupted. Dissociated, patchy, and disrupted, Oscar says. Yeah, that's basically it. So then what? I sued you. Well, you weren't considered legally to be in possession of sound mind at that time. You couldn't remember visiting Nepenthe, so bringing a suit was difficult. It was your former legal guardians, your aunt and uncle, along with other people acting on behalf of the other subjects who brought a suit against Nepenthe, and Nepenthe settled. I was living with my relatives then. No, you spent some time in a private hospital. You were disoriented. No shit, Oscar says. Wasn't it in the newspapers, the case? No, it was confidential. But why was it confidential to me? Why didn't anyone explain what happened to me? Dr. Medvedev says that before the study began, Oscar signed something to say that no matter what happened to him, he didn't want the memory back. Later on, when it became obvious that Oscar's brain was fucked, teams of people argued about this in court. The decision was made to honor the original agreement because they thought that it might do even more damage to tell Oscar about a past he couldn't remember. So it was agreed that they'd tell him that he'd suffered brain damage affecting his long-term memory. And maybe if so many people in suits hadn't been involved in this telling process, or so many legal documents, or later, so much money, they might have been more plausible. Or maybe Oscar remembered his dad's warning after all, because he didn't trust any of them. I ran, he says. Yes. But then Nepenthe was looking for me, the man in Brighton, the guy in Budapest, the calls to the hotel. How did you know I was there? Was it the card? I didn't use the card at the Riyadh. I'll answer this if I may, says the Nepenthe solicitor. Oscar's already forgotten his name. Probably a normal person would have forgotten it too, under the circumstances. Your family hired someone to look for you after you absconded. They were worried, but you disappeared, and after a few months, they couldn't afford to pursue you. Then this year, we engaged a firm. Wait, Oscar says. This year? So I've been on the run for years, and nobody was even looking for me. The Nepenthe solicitor nods. There's a long silence. Do you need a minute? Says the Nepenthe solicitor eventually. Use your eyes, Michael Goldman says. He needs a minute. Some minutes pass. The Nepenthe solicitor resumes. In spring this year, we engaged a firm to track down the former RASA patients and make them aware of their right to a restoration procedure. Your bank account is administered by family trustees, and they gave Nepenthe permission to use the account information to trace you. As for the Riyadh, it says here, yes, a social media user named Jess to Impress posted a picture of you on the Instagram app, a public forum, which was picked up by our facial recognition software. She also included the name of the Riyadh as a hashtag. Right, Oscar said. At least now he could contact Jess and send her a proper apology. But then they found me at the airport. Frobisher did. That was actually a coincidence. The investigator had submitted that you could be considered to have refused contact, and he was moving on to the next assignment. Synchronology, says Oscar, momentarily delighted. Typical. So, hang on, you were just giving up. You were going to leave me alone. So to speak, yes. Then why chase me so hard in the first place? After the news came out that memories could be reclaimed, Nepenthe committed to make every reasonable effort to notify the RASA test subjects and offer them the memory back. That's a lot of effort, Oscar said. Tracking down a load of nutters like me, I mean. You'd think that was above and beyond. Actually, Michael Goldman says. The representatives of some of the other RASA patients sued Nepenthe and won. They argued that as Nepenthe were going to offer their self-confidential patients the chance to have the memory restored, the same went for the RASA patients, more so, given that the impact on their mental health and quality of life was so much greater. It was another sealed case. You wouldn't have heard about it in the media. Anyway, the ruling was that Nepenthe had a duty of care to track down the former patients and offer them restoration. Which we committed to do, says the Nepenthe solicitor. And this is important, Oscar. The details of the case are still confidential. You'd be in breach of the terms of the settlement if you discuss it with anyone now. Yes. Nepenthe fought for that one, and they won. Michael Goldman says, without looking at the Nepenthe solicitor. We maintain that anonymity continues to be in the best interests of the patients, says the Nepenthe solicitor, without looking at Michael Goldman. How kind of you, Oscar says. He's not really listening. He's running the knobs of the gold necklace between his thumb and finger. Michael Goldman looks worried. You understand, right, Oscar? You can't tell anyone about this. You could challenge the decision legally, of course, but I have to warn you that this... I don't care, Oscar says. It doesn't matter. After all this time, it was his own teeth. Jess was right. The teeth of someone he'd killed.